So we will get started with our keynote address, which will be presented by our national representative and president of NFB of Colorado, Scott Labar.
Mind what I said then. Good evening. I my speech up here. It's 427 pages long. 8x11 braille paper. I'm hoping that you reserved a room till Tuesday. Got a lot of important things to say. First of all, I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for the warmth of your welcome here and just how wonderful your convention has been. I've got to admit, this is my first major NFB in-person event since the onset of this awful pandemic. And, in some ways was a little anxious about all this, because I really haven't done this. Well, in fact, the last state convention that I did in person was the NFB of Texas. Anybody here from Texas?
Yeah.
That was in November of 2019, the last major federation event that I attended in person was our Washington seminar in 2020, which was in early February when we were just starting to hear about the virus. So it's been a long time. And I just want to say I'm so glad that this was my first trip back on the road with the Federation. And I want to thank you for the way you've welcomed me and made me feel at ease here and have reminded me, you have reminded me of the value of our Federation family. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, our Federation family, where we are and where we still need to go. And with respect to family, it's been a particularly moving week for me. My wife, Anahit, and I have two children, Alexander, or as he likes to say, Alex, and Emily. And the reason it's been particularly moving to me is on Thursday, before coming here, or I tried to get here on Thursday night, the tornadoes in Denver prevented that, so I got here yesterday. But on Thursday, we moved Alexander into college. And he's going to be attending the University of Colorado, or I shouldn't say going to be. He is attending the University of Colorado at Boulder, wants to get an aerospace degree. So who knows? Maybe he'll come down here to North Charleston and work at Boeing. You just never know, right? You never know. And so when I think about the Federation and where we are as blind people, I think about the fact that we've made lots of strides and that we have done great things and the future is bright and hopeful. The other side of that, though, is the fact that we still face many barriers and we run into those all the time as well. But I was particularly thinking of my son, Alexander, this week because he represents to me the hope that is there. And, you know, when you go through an experience with your first child going off to college, you just kind of think back to all those days when he was a little dude and he was really cute and pleasant and wonderful. And then they become teenagers. Well, he's a great kid, don't get me wrong, but he went through his teenager stuff, you know, and kids have to do that because they have to start to chart their own path in the world, and they push the boundaries. It's all normal. But anyway, I was thinking about the cute years. I was thinking about, in particular, one day when I believe we were going somewhere after an NFP chapter meeting. And in those days, we drug our kids everywhere. We really had no choice, right? And in those days, at first when he was a little kid, I remember the little kid carrier I could put on my shoulders and carry him around. He loved that thing. But by the time he was walking he and talking, he went through a phase where he really loved anything having to do with trains. So in particular, in Denver, he loved riding our light rails. And he'd get so excited to get on them. And I remember one time, I don't know, maybe he was 3 years old, but he turned to me and he said, "Daddy, you're blind." "Yes, I know, son, I know." "Well, how are you gonna know when to get on the light rail, Daddy? How are you gonna know?" And I didn't say anything for a second. Then he said, "Oh, I know, Daddy. You're gonna hear it coming. And you're gonna hear it pull up, and you're gonna know when to get on the train, right, Daddy?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely, Alexander. Here you are, you're just a little kid, and you've already figured out that there are other ways to do things, and that we don't have to do everything in the world with sight. How can we explain that to the rest of the public? It's that simple, isn't it? As I've said earlier today, undoubtedly, the way we experience the world is different, but it's not inferior. We come up with different ways to get the same job done. And simply because we do so doesn't mean that we are not entitled to any fewer rights or responsibilities in our society. And the reason that is true is the National Federation of the Blind. So I wish I could tell you that all the news about my family was good, that everybody got it and inherently understood my blindness. Well, it's not true. I'm thinking back about 3 years ago now, when I was turning.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing. Anyway, in July of 2018, I was turning 50. My wife asked me, "What do you want to do for your big kid?" And I happen to be a huge fan of the Irish rock band U2. I happen to think they're the greatest band in the world, or at least one of them. They were on tour in the U.S. Fortunately, they weren't coming to Denver. They always come to Denver. I don't know why they did this last time. I've been in conflict with the stadium. But they were playing in New York at Madison Square Garden right around my birthday. In fact, the night before. By the way, that was July 1st. And on July 2nd, I flew down to a convention in turned 50. But anyway, so I asked my wife if she wanted to go with me to see you too. Well, not so much of a fan. She said, no, I would be really happy if you would take a friend and just go. Somebody would actually enjoy it. And okay, sweetie, I'll go. As always, sweetie, I'll do it. Right, she's the boss. I might try to pretend differently sometimes, but I do so in my own fear. So
And I said, no, not really. And I suppose some do, but I certainly haven't observed over the years a increased rate of suicide among blind people because we are blind. And that in fact, blind people can live pretty damn good lives. And there's, once you adjust to blindness, there's absolutely no reason to think about killing yourself purely because you're blind. And again, I was shocked because this person knows me, knows my story, knows my success. Yet those attitudes, those negative attitudes build deep inside of many of us and don't go away. And they tell me that we just have to double our commitment to changing the attitudes about blindness. And so this was kind of hard to take from family members, but of course it's not just trouble dealing with our families. It's trouble we encounter in every aspect of society. Now, I guess it's because, well, at least before the pandemic, I traveled a lot. I would travel on average over 100,000 miles a year, all over the world in many years. And so I guess a lot of my life revolved around airports. So that's seemingly where I encountered a lot of the negative attitudes about blindness. Now, some of you in this room, and maybe some of you listening out there in the Zoomosphere, have heard my story about, well, now really it's airport people, but I got to tell you a story if you indulge me, because I still like this story. Well, I like it because of the way it happened. It was so absurd, but it's also emblematic of what still happens. It even happened to me yesterday when I flew down here, not in the same way as I'm about to describe, but the same kind of treatment occurs. So about 11 years ago now, as I was traveling to the Washington State Convention to serve as national representative there, I encountered Airport Guy. Now, this is an experience with which many of you can relate. Although this particular incident about which I'm going to speak occurred in 2010, variations of it keep occurring during my travels throughout the world. Again, as I say, I haven't done that much in the last 18 months, but who knows, maybe I'm starting again. So I had first traveled to Sacramento, where I had represented a bunch of blind vendors in a legal hearing in a particular case we had going at that time. And I had to transfer through San Francisco's airport on my way to my ultimate destination. Now, I had about an hour to effect the transfer, and my advanced research indicated that I had to travel the overwhelming distance of six gates, from gate 72 to gate 70, from gate 78 to gate 72. Now, I was not particularly daunted by this task, and I certainly did not request any assistance in San Francisco. Nevertheless, as I alighted from my regional jet onto the jet bridge, there stood Airport Guy with wheelchair humming and ready to go. Now, he first commanded me to sit down. Not even a hello or a how are you doing, just sit down. Now, I responded by saying that I would be fine and that my legs worked perfectly well and that I had a lot of time and that I really did not need any additional assistance. Unfazed by my comments, good old Airport Guy started following me down the jetway, and the chase began. Now, somehow, I navigated the bewildering straight ahead corridor of the jetway and found myself on the surface of the concourse. Airport Guy close on my heels. The direction to gate 72 was to my left, and I proceeded on said bearing, walking at my normal speed. At first, I thought old Airport Guy was attempting to break into an old Simon and Garfunkel song, because he started to say, sort of sing, sort of yell, slow down, you're moving too fast. I soon realized that this really wasn't his intent, because he deviated from the lyric by saying, you're going to hurt yourself. It's dangerous out here. Nevertheless, I was feeling groovy, and I proceeded on course towards good old Gate 72. I was feeling groovy, that is, until I became part of my very own Kafka novel and realized the metamorphosis. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I transformed from Scott C. LaBar to a piece of luggage. Not happy with my rate of speed and my seeming contentment with the world as it is, old airport guy latched onto me and attempted to lug me along as his very own carry-on baggage. However, I'm not so sure that I would have fit in the overhead bin or underneath the seat. After pirouetting down the concourse, attempting to avoid the clutch of airport guy, while verbally telling him that I truly was groovy, our circus act miraculously wound up at gate 72. At the time of arrival, a good 20 or 25 minutes still remained until United Airlines would start boarding my connecting flight. I told old airport guy that I was just fine and that he could go and help somebody else. Apparently, he had the audacity to doubt my veracity. And he stood right next to me and waited until it was time to board my connecting flight. Well, once I got past the boarding gate reader, I thought I would be free at last. But no airport guy pursued me down yet another jetway. Once again, loudly admonishing me that I was moving too fast and that there were huge hills on the jet bridge. Now, I didn't retreat from my normal walking pace, and bravely, ladies and gentlemen, confronted the hills ahead, hoping to arrive safely at the next aluminum tube known as my connecting aircraft. When I did not heed the warnings to slow down, airport guy gravely predicted that I would fall and most certainly get hurt. Ah, at last I arrived to the friendly greetings of the flight attendant, who welcomed me aboard. And at that time, I safely negotiated the awe-inspiring gap between the jet bridge and the aircraft of, I don't know, maybe an inch, a few centimeters, whatever it is. And airport described it as a dangerous crevasse about which I would get hurt. Finally, when flight attendant Gel told airport guy, I've got him. I was rid of airport guy. So I slumped down into my complimentary upgraded first class seat. And the gin and tonic I sipped soon after takeoff was the best darn drink I'd ever had, because airport guy was miles behind me and thousands of feet below me. Obviously now, 11 years later, I'm still having PTSD about all this. But I can recount the story with some humor and embellishment, but really not a lot of embellishment. Airport guy made me feel like I was something subhuman, that I was really, I felt like a piece of luggage. He was trying to drag me around. Now, don't get me wrong. When we request assistance and need assistance, we ought to get it. I'll be honest with you. Yesterday, I got assistance at the Denver airport. I'll tell you why. There were huge problems at the Denver airport because the train system that brings people between the various concourses had broken down. And there was a crowd literally in the lobby of the security area of over 5,000 people. And every normal, and the airport's under construction, and I hadn't really been in it for a year and a half, and I didn't have time to waste. So I asked for assistance, and I got it, but it was respectful. They did what I asked. So the point here is we need to be in control. We need to be in charge of our own destinies. But when help is forced upon us, and when our wishes are not listened to and respected, we must stand up for ourselves. Now, again, my life seems to revolve around airport stories, and I have another one. Because airport guy was not the only encounter that I had. There was an airport bar gal. Now, this particular story is just a few years ago when I was traveling home from an NFB board of directors meeting, and I happened to be with Francisco Chang, who's the husband to Patty, and he was heading home also on United to Chicago, and I was heading home on United to Denver, and obviously the Baltimore airport, those gates are right next to each other. And we got to the airport quite early. Now, Patty wasn't going home yet because she had other work to do at the National. So, you know, we headed to the airport. Our flights were around the same time. And so this is very, very rare for me. So I said, Francisco, we got a lot of time to kill. Why don't we hit a bar? As I say, I never do such things, but made an exception on this day. So I happen to know this bar called the Green Turtle, which is right by gate, what is that, D9 and 11, which is very close to the United Gates. So I usually had good experiences in the Green Turtle. So we went into the Green Turtle. And this bar attendant gal came up to us, and she's like, and of course she was talking to Francisco, right? Not me. We're really busy in here. I don't know where you're gonna sit. The only thing we have left are stools, high stools. Can he sit on a high stool? Now, Francisco, being well trained by Patty, certainly urged this bar attendant Gail to talk to me. And I said, you know what? I'm going to be fine. No problem. Let's just show us to the open stools. So she did. And I was sitting there, and I was tempted to kind of swoon off the stool and kind of mess with her a little bit. But she came over several times and was really worried about me. Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you comfortable? Or are you safe? Well, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, I've never had anyone be so interested in my stool, not even my doctor. I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about airports. I think people become crazy inside airports. They lose all their common sense. Even yesterday, I was getting on the plane. This flight attendant freaked out. Now, I was sitting in row like four. So, I mean, I was like really, you know, well, four rows back. And she was really worried about how I could find my way there. And she grabbed onto both my hands and was, and I had my cane and my backpack and my suitcase, both of my hands. And she was trying to drag me along and she was walking backwards like this. And I thought if she trips over something and I fall on her, I'm gonna get sued. And she made sure she was trying to push me down in the seat. I was trying to say, ma'am, I'm okay, really, I'm okay. And she came back to me and said, I've got to give you a briefing. And she's grabbing my hands again. I guess she kind of dug me or something, but I don't know what was going on. But I said, ma'am, I have flown a lot. I've flown over a million miles on United Airlines. I think I can figure out where the flight attendant call button is. I think she finally started to get it, because by the end of the flight, she was great. But why is it we keep facing all of this? Well, I'll tell you why. Because even within the blindness community, we always don't portray the right story. Now, the next story I'm going to tell you comes from an organization that's well-known in the blindness field, and I think they largely do good work. However, sometimes their messaging isn't the greatest. And I'm talking about the Foundation Fighting Blindness. A few years back, they had a fundraising challenge that they called the hashtag How I See It campaign. Do you guys remember that? Here's what they were doing. They were encouraging people to put on a blindfold and try some everyday tasks. And the whole message was, of course, good Lord, if you go blind and try to do all this, you would face a real struggle. And so they had literally identified, I think I counted 67 things you could try with a blindfold on. And they're all supposed, they were meant to be challenging and meant to have you really think about how much it would suck to go blind. And of course, they asked you to donate money. What they also wanted you to do, I guess this came out of the old ice bucket challenge thing. Remember that? They wanted you to record it and post your videos. All right. So anyway, here we go with the list of, I don't know how many this is exactly, but sort of Scott's top 10-ish of the challenges that they had for you. For all you guide dog users, now imagine these are things that would be really tough if you put on a blindfold. Here we go, number one, give your dog a bath. Number two, choose the right floor in an elevator with more than 20 floors. Now let's stop here for a moment and think about how absurd that statement is. Have any of you been in an elevator that has more than 20 floors? Of course, what they meant is choose a floor from the 20 or more buttons. But anyway, never mind. Now, Jennifer, you're president of this affiliate. Yes? Jennifer, I mean, yeah. So the other thing you're supposed to do with a blindfold on, it would be really difficult. You get ready?
Yes.
Conduct a board meeting. All right, how many of you out there love ice cream? Yeah, well, it'd be hard for you, because another one of the challenge was eat a double scoop of ice cream on a cone. Here's for me, the peripatetic traveler. Find your seat on a plane. Tell a friend how to get to your house by memory alone. Now, these last three are all related. Speed date. Get married. Go for just a minute. taking care of your newborn baby. So what they are trying to tell us is, if you go blind, all of these tasks, from traveling on a plane, to taking care of your dog, to dating, to getting married, to running a board meeting, to eating ice cream, and maybe even, most offensively, taking care of a newborn, all of these would be terribly difficult as a blind person, and that's why you need to fight blindness so hard. Now, get it. I get it. I have no problem, none at all, with funding research and figuring out how to avoid blindness if it can be avoided. No problem with that at all. But why does that have to come at the price of our dignity, at the price of our freedom? It should not. Because those of us who have gone blind or born blind, we know that we can figure out a way to live with it and know how to live deeply enriching and meaningful lives. And that's why we have the National Federation of the Blind. So, where are we? Well, thank you. Ba-dum-bumps. She's here all weekend, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget to tip your bar attendants and waiters and bartenders. I flew in all the way from Denver to hear this act, and my arms are killing me. Anyway, thank you, Jennifer. So we really do have to ask, you know, where are we? And is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? I think it's more than half full. I think that in 1940, we as a people adopted, I guess you would think of it as our own Declaration of Independence, and declared our own rights. Our fundamental message is that our blindness does not make us inherently inferior. We are entitled to all the rights and freedoms and responsibilities as others. Blindness, as I said earlier, undoubtedly alters the way in which we experience the world, but it does not alter our right to live in it, our right to live meaningful and rich lives. We can truly live the life we want. As Dr. Tenbrick so eloquently said, the blind have a right to live in the world. That right is as deep as human nature, as pervasive as the need for social existence, as ubiquitous as the human race, as invincible as the human spirit. As their souls are their own, so their destiny must be their own. Their salvation or their failure lies within their own choice and responsibility. That choice cannot be precluded or prejudged. Those lives cannot be predetermined or controlled. As we celebrate our great accomplishments as a movement, we can think about all the challenges that we undoubtedly face. But let us not dwell there too long. We are filled with great hope and joy, and we know that true freedom and equality for the blind are with in our reach. First-class citizenship for us is no longer just a fanciful dream. We will make it our reality. We have touched the flame of freedom and it has ignited our hearts, minds, and souls. We will live the lives we want. Now, let's join together, march forward to the future, and make all of our dreams come true. Thank you.
Thank you. I know why you needed some water now. That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. I failed to mention the head table.